Hello, my name is Holly Lewis.
I'm Lawson Keeney.
And I am Jean Lewis.
And welcome to The Long Watch, the internet's premier pro-John Lithgow podcast where we stick to the list for better or worse. This week we have discussed yet another science fiction movie.
Yet another more serious adaptation.
Yeah, than what was originally presented in the 80s. This time we are covering Dread, which came out same year as Total Recall, and it's sort of like a brother film to this one.
Yeah, I've always
associated them in my head, same as that remake of RoboCop.
Yeah.
See, I would say that there's another movie that this is much more directly akin to, but I'll save that for the discussion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dredd is, of course, based off the comic book character, Judge Dredd, but we'll get into that when we're doing our deep dive. But first, we're going to discuss what we've watched within the week. We all went to the cinemas this week.
We did. We went and we saw Madam Web. It is a superhero movie directed by S.J. Clarkson. It's the latest in Sony's We Have Marvel at Home series. And it follows Cassandra Webb, played by Dakota Johnson. She's a paramedic in New York. She is resuscitated after her heart stops after an accident on the job and finds herself seeing the future begins to learn that this newfound ability might be connected with her mother's past in the Amazon. Her mother died giving birth to her, or so she thinks, in the Amazon, researching spiders. But she sees a vision of the future, of the mysterious Ezekiel Sims, played by Taha Rahim, killing three teenagers. Julia Cornwall, played by Sydney Sweeney, Anya Corazon, played by Isabella Merced, and Celeste O'Connor, played by Maddie Franklin. And she intervenes to prevent this.
No. Maddie Franklin, played by Celeste O'Connor.
Ah, sorry. Yep. Go with that one. She intervenes to prevent this. But it turns out that he has powers too. He can see the future also, and he too might have links to her mother. So it sort of becomes this battle between two people who can see the immediate future.
He also has the proportional strength and speed of a spider.
Yeah. Where was she?
And he was also in the Amazon with her mother when she was researching spiders before she died.
Yeah.
Nailed it. That's not in the movie. That is so always just a dubbed over line for the trailer, so the marketing people could close
lots of dubbed over stuff this time around.
Anyways, why don't we each go around and say what we thought of this? Why don't you start us off, Jean? Do we normally start with Jean? Yep.
Yeah. I completely forgot that we had gone to the cinema to watch this movie until Harley mentioned it. It's not good. It's not completely terrible. I think the actresses do a fine job. I don't know what happened with Tahir, who plays Ezekiel Sims in this movie. It seems like he's been dubbed over multiple times. There is some atrocious ADR here that it makes it seem like they've tried to resuscitate this movie multiple times, but it hasn't quite worked. I think people wanted this to be so bad it's entertaining, but it's just so mid that it slips out of your mind as quickly as it enters into it. Yeah.
So for me, everyone knows I'm a pretty big Spider-Man fan. I'm familiar with a lot of the Spider-Man-based characters. And I do think that there are some characters that can have their own, like, fully-fledged live-action movie, perhaps live-action franchise. Venom, I think, works, and I like the Venom movies thus far. Morbius had potential that was very, very squandered, and I really hope they can stick the landing on Kraven the Hunter.
Although, at this point,
my vote is no.
The hopes are not high.
Hey, at least it's R-rated. That gives me some hope.
Yeah, but it's about a guy who gets powers because a lion bleeds into his open wound. Like, I can't get over that.
Spider-Man gets powers because he was bitten by a radioactive spider.
Well, yes, but that's like at least a sci-fi kind of thing.
I think
anyone can have an animal bleed into their open wound.
Like, there's a way to spin it like that's his mutant power. He can absorb the proportional abilities of an animal when he either consumes them or comes in contact with their blood. That's why he's a hunter. That's why he gets stronger and stronger.
But anyway,
I know, there's something to do there. But Madam Web, Now, that's a character that was introduced in a lot of the comic book Spider-Verse stuff, has existed as a character on the peripheries for a very, very long time. Never expected to see a movie based on her. I expect her to show up at some point in one of these Spider-Verse animated things, because she's like crucial to that storyline at the center of the web of life and death, that kind of thing. But this movie was kind of a big nothing, and I'm not mad at the movie for wasting the character, because I don't think there was much that was going to be there to begin with for a Madam Web movie.
I'm not even disappointed.
This feels like one of the most desperate efforts to grab a Spider-Man character and go, here, we're making a movie about it. I just think it's a waste of the act.
Yeah.
Because the act is a talented. Dakota Johnson, God, she does what she can, but what she can just, I guess, isn't enough to bring back something so dull.
When she has dialogue scenes with the three girls, they try their very best to just do character stuff. They try their best to have fun comedy bits.
Mm.
And Dakota Johnson is a talented comedic actor, as far as I'm concerned. It's just the moment those scenes stop, it gets back to just Ezekiel Sims in a bloody penthouse saying, "But I need to find them, because they're gonna kill me!"
I do think there was potential with some of the concepts. Not the characters, but the concepts. The idea of a slasher movie villain with the powers of Spider-Man. Sort of like the whole Brightburn-Superman connection. Like, there's potential there for something very cool. What happens when the slasher villain can walk on walls? There's the idea of the precognitive stuff, like seeing the future existing in multiple timelines. I like how that was handled here. But again, that seems like it could be just a little more interesting if it wasn't wrapped up in all of the expectations that come with the Spider-Man connection.
And their Spider-Man connection in this movie is the most tortured thing.
Lawson was invisible pain when one of the characters' names was told to us. But I think it's the worst thing about it is that very little of it has stuck in my head. Morbius, I remember even though I don't want to, but it still stuck. It had something that just lingers in my head and will probably do so for the rest of time at this point.
The most entertaining thing about this movie was watching Lawson react to it in real time.
Yes.
Because he had a look at his face like he tasted something horrible.
The most memorable thing about Morbius is the Matt Smith stuff.
Yeah.
But that was, I think, deliberate to a degree.
Mm.
With this, the most memorable thing is that we actually went to the cinemas to see it with you.
Mm.
And when I'm there to watch a movie, that shouldn't be the case.
See, the ironic thing is that you both have had a much more negative reaction to this than I have. I will say just off the top, there's been a lot of talk since that Sora AI video generator thing came out about its potential impact on Hollywood. But to be perfectly honest, if AI ever does end up making movies, I just foresee them making a lot of Madam Webs because this is a movie that feels like what an AI would make if an AI could make movies. It is every other superhero movie that's ever been made, gobbled up, chewed into nothingness, and then vomited back out at the whims of an algorithm with no artistic intent behind it. You know,
and then actors being forced at almost gunpoint to perform it.
If that's where we end up, that we have AI being used as to do basically what CG already does, and then you have a couple of like bargain bin VOD, like the stuff that Steven Seagal and that lot, John Cusack, the stuff they get up to now, you get some of those that are completely AI generated, but we still have the majority of the actual good movies are made by humans. I suppose I could live with that. But in any case, the yardstick here for me is that this is a movie that is better than Aquaman 2, Black Adam, Justice League, the theatrical cut, and maybe, I'd have to probably watch them again to decide, the first two Ant-Man movies. For me, this is where I'm at.
I think there's a little more, there's more interesting stuff in those first two Ant-Man movies.
I'll agree with you on that one.
I want to hear your
in terms of technical ability.
Yes,
there's
the two Ant-Man
on.
Movies are better made movies, but they are less entertaining to me than Madame Web is.
That's fair.
This bears the scars of the development process. Like, you just wait for a few months down the line when we get the gossipy Hollywood Reporter article about what exactly happened with this, because clearly something did. I mean, you already mentioned the ADR, and it's genuinely lazy because they've not even tried to match it to the way that the mouth is moving on screen, which makes you wonder, like, they had to veer so far away from what was originally said. They had no other option, surely, or they would have taken it. But the screenplay is just awful, and I just got to think, you know, hey, Sony, maybe get the people who did Gods of Egypt and Power Rangers out of the driver's seat if you want this stuff to take off. Mm. The effects are kind of laughable. The physics are ridiculous and wonky on pretty much everything. The narrative itself is extremely clumsy. It is, again, the 2003 to 2007 superhero movie syndrome, where it's doing that Daredevil, Fantastic Electra. Four, Elektra kind of thing, Cat Ghost Woman. Rider. So I don't understand. And you know, if you look at the people who produced this movie or are heavily involved in producing most of Sony's output, it's all the people who were involved in making that stuff. And I don't understand why they're still around. Because maybe the common thread is them.
They have more misses than hits.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, yeah.
The actresses all deserved better. Johnson in particular is trying so hard. You do get a decent supporting performance by Adam Scott. But speaking of Adam Scott, I, like you said, the really desperate attempts to wrap in a broader continuity to justify the existence of this movie is so tiring.
You look actually angry.
It's sweaty. It's clumsy. It does have a few good ideas. Like I mentioned, the idea of two precogs in battle with each other, but not really in battle with each other, but basically one trying to save the lives of these girls and the other trying to take them.
The constant one-upsmanship.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. The villain is essentially, he has Spider-Man's powers, absent the web slinging. But, like, that's a cool idea. What if Spider-Man was evil? What if he could do all the acrobatics and the wall climbing and everything? Like, that's a pretty interesting idea. It's entertaining on a base level. It manages to mostly avoid boredom for me, which I can't say for the others that I mentioned.
Sure.
The second act does get quite tedious, I found. And I think it's very clear that Clarkson's direction has gotten away from her very quickly. I don't want to blame her because this has all of the hallmark signs of a movie that was meddled with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to wait until I hear about that. But, like, it's just there's some very strange choices. Like, at the very start, in the opening flashback sequence to her mother in the Amazon, it does these, like, weird documentary-style zooms mid-shot.
Yeah, and that I saw never, that, and I thought...
It never comes up again. It never turns up in the rest of the movie. The editing is jarring. The storytelling is very jarring as well. It sort of jumps around a lot. The action is very rote and uninspired. I mean, all in all, it's just like, you know, I get why Sony wants to make this thing go, because the Spider-Man movies are the thing that they are the most profitable movies that Sony makes. But it's become so clear that absent the Spider-Verse exception, they should be just striking a deal with Marvel to work them into the MCU like they did Spider-Man. Like, if they had actually struck a deal like that to get Venom his own movie, to get Kraven the Hunter his own movie, perhaps, Madame Web probably wouldn't have gone. But, like, I think that worked into the MCU, that stuff would have made them a lot more money, even sharing the profits, than they have done by themselves.
Because even when Marvel misses, it makes bank.
No, not anymore.
No, well, anymore. You know.
Quantumania.
Well, there's a lot of exhaustion.
Yeah. Quantumania and the Marvels both lost money. The Marvels, significant amounts of money.
Even though that one was a lot of fun.
But yeah. That's Madame Web. It's not as bad as people would want you to believe. It's not going to be the Catwoman-style, like, campy cult classic years from now. It's not that bad. It's just going to fade away.
Yeah.
At home, I saw two movies. I saw two pro shots of Shakespeare, the Globe Theatre, doing a production of Henry IV, parts 1
Starting
and 2.
Starting off 2024 strong, hey, with a lot of Shakespeare.
Yes, and in this instance, Shakespeare that I only just recently watched as part of The Hollow Crown. This is a pro shot of the same plays. Henry IV, Part 1, it's a historical drama directed by Dominic Drumgoole and Robin Lowe. It's a pro shot, as I said, follows Henry IV, played by Oliver Cotton. He's King of England. There's a rebellion against him, while at the same time he is exasperated with his son, Hal, played by Jamie Parker, who just sort of hangs around with bad influences, chiefly the thief and scoundrel Falstaff, played by Roger Alam. Seeing it so soon after seeing the Hollow Crown version is really interesting. Seeing it on stage, unabridged, rather than done as a filmed version, that's quite interesting. And I've got to say that this two-parter is one of the Globe's better productions. I always have a bit of a hit-or-miss relationship with the Globe because they never really, and this is by design, they never really try anything hugely out of step with the traditional interpretation of the play. They're a very conservative company in terms of their approach to the material. They just do it set in the time period it was originally written in, and they just follow the text and the interpretation on the page. But this really works, this version. The unabridged bits contextualize some of the stuff that I was missing in the Hollow Crown version. And you got an excellent cast. I mean, Parker and Cotton are both very, very good. You get a very good supporting turn by an actor named William Gaunt, who is a bit of a scene stealer. But really, the story here is Roger Alam. He is hugely successful as Falstaff. Is apparently considered to be one of the best modern Falstaffs. He really, like, just captivates every time he's on screen. It is the perfect blend of, like, roguishness and pomposity, which makes that character what it is. And I like him, this interpretation of him, a lot more than Simon Russell Beale's interpretation in The Hollow Crown. And I like Simon Russell Beale's interpretation a lot, which tells you how much I like Roger Alam's version. It really accentuates the humor in a way that that movie didn't. It really plays to the live audience with all of the hijinks with Falstaff. It's funny, and it really works well in front of this crowd who's eating it up. I will say that an actor named Sam Crane lets the team down a bit. He's playing, I suppose, the closest thing this play has to a villain. The character Hotspur, who is sort of like driving the rebellion, the champion of the rebellion. He's supposed to be angry and hot-headed and, impulsive. But Sam Crane just turns him into a whiner. Extremely grating, very difficult to take seriously as a leader of men. The next one I saw was Henry IV, Part 2, directed by Drumgoole and Ross McGibbon. The rebellion is still ongoing, but Henry has become very sick. And Hal is alarmed by this because he realizes he's going to have to become king soon. Meanwhile, Falstaff is Mr. Beaning his way through it all in an attempt to gain greater wealth and standing through his relationship with the prince. This is, again, a very strong version. There's a lot of energy here. It really threads the needle of the Globe's traditionalism. It's still the lesser part of the two parts. It still has structural problems, which I talked about in my discussion of the version that The Hollow Crown did. Separating Falstaff and Hal is a huge issue, but Alam's Falstaff is still a dynamite performance, and the bits of comedy business that they give him in this work much better, because William Gaunt is back as a different character. His character in the first play is killed off in the first play, so he's back playing this sort of like dotty old friend of Falstaff's called Shallow, and it's a very entertaining, very campy and sort of exaggerated performance, and it really works and adds to the comedy, and he and Alam work very well together, and it makes that whole part of the play work a lot better than it did for me in The Hollow Crown. Parker and Cotton, just like Jeremy Irons and Tom Hiddleston, don't get enough to do together. They should have more scenes than they do. This is just a fault in Shakespeare's original imagining of it. But I will say that their scenes together aren't pitched in a way that hits as hard as The Hollow Crowns do. It's missing a little bit of the tragedy of the father-son relationship, the sadness of that. There is more for the supporting cast to do in the second part than there was in the first, and they don't all rise to the challenge. Some of them are better than others, but all in all, I will say that, the it's impossible for me not to compare it to The Hollow Crown, having seen it so recently, and that production to be so good. I would say all in all that The Hollow Crown is the version of this to watch because it gives you the most like the most sort of complete version of the story with excellent performances, and it actually makes a lot of really smart choices in adapting and abridging down, which this and when I say that, I mean also in terms of like combining choices in casting and choices in suggesting that two characters are actually the same character, that actually like by casting the same actor in both, and it's they combine two characters who appear apart from each other in different scenes in the original play, and that actually really works when the Hollow Crown does it. I mean, it just makes a lot of little choices like that that this doesn't, and I think that it there are trade-offs. I mean, obviously the stage version is unabridged, so all of the stuff that I was complaining about with the Hollow Crown, where I found the rebellion stuff a little hard to follow, who was who, what the machinations were, that's easier to pass now. But the clarity of the scenes themselves are gone, and the or isn't there as much, and the sort of heft and impact of the scenes, the power that the Hollow Crown gained from being able to take its time, from being able to choose how it approached scenes because of the added techniques that film allowed them. That's gone. That's not to say that a film version of a Shakespeare play automatically is the best one. It isn't. But I think that The Hollow Crown approached that in such a smart way that I think that this second part, the Globe Theatre, hasn't approached their stage version in as smart a way. And so, all in all, I would say if you're going to watch these two, I would actually say watch the three. All of the Henriad and the Hollow Crown to really get the story of it. But it's a very worthy production of a play that has some problems. Play has some problems. But that is me done for the week. What about you guys? What have you been watching? And please be aware that I think we're going to have to end our discussion of Dread, start wrapping it up at 10:50. So that'll be.
Yeah, we don't really have anything. We've been catching Mum and Dad up on a lot of the movies that are on our lists. Just the stuff that they didn't get around to last year.
But I do have a pith take.
Yes.
So, I only call this a pith take because I don't know how else to discuss this. So, you guys have both seen the original American Pie film.
No.
No?
I have, obviously.
Never mind then. I was gonna talk about a thing that I did on the Gemini AI, the new Google chatbot, but never mind. I'll talk to
That's
you
not
about
a
it
pith
after.
take.
Instead of that,
Sorry, did you
instead
have
of that,
something?
oh, I do have another thing. So recently, a DLC for God of War Ragnarok released called God of War Valhalla, and I would like to speak about it just for a little bit because recently I've completed the story portion of it. This is set after the main events of God of War Ragnarok, and Kratos and Mimir have received a letter inviting them to run the gauntlet of Valhalla, where they will both have to confront their past so that they can grow and become who they are supposed to be in the future. This is a roguelite, and it is perfect. It is exactly what this game needed to get people back into it, because the combat is the thing that is so great about God of War Ragnarok. The story is also really interesting. We get a returning character of at least the decapitated head of Helios, who those who've played God of War would recall
Particularly
had his
number
head
three.
chopped off by Kratos.
Chopped and then ripped off.
Chopped and then ripped off. And we get a lot of talk about Kratos' past, specifically past games. Discussions about his time in Greece, we get some additional gameplay elements, including the ability to use the Blade of Olympus from the second game, which is also, which when I saw, I just had to grin
Like,
because
story-wise, there's no real good reason for it, but it's cool that it's
it's
there.
so cool. There's a lot of fan service stuff here. We get more information about the Valkyries that work with Sigrun and with Freya. And we get a lot of really interesting stuff where Kratos is trying to wrestle with the horrible things that he's done.
Do they address, like, any of the Chain of Memories stuff with, like, Kratos' brother?
Yes.
Oh, that's...
They straight up mention a lot of stuff that they didn't get to in the base game.
Cool.
Including Pandora, including his brother, obviously, including the time where he actually went to the underworld to save Helios. There's a lot of references to even the PSP games, and there's even references to the original ending of the first game, which kind of left things up in the air with him still being the God of War.
Into the modern day.
Into the modern day, but they do interesting stuff with that. But again, this is a roguelite, and that is perfect for this particular game, because you get to choose which shield you want, which weapon.
It also kind of works for the concept of Valhalla.
Exactly.
Like the eternal battle. What do you think about this new trend of a lot of games adding in roguelite stuff, like God of War just did that, Assassin's Creed Valhalla had that, and of course the remaster for Last of Us 2 has the No Return DLC that came out. So what do you think about this particular trend, Lawson?
I mean, as long as there's story, I'm interested. Like, I'm not interested in going through just battle tournaments for no purpose. Like, that's my thing. I don't play multiplayer games in part because of that. God of War one sounds up my alley because it has narrative elements, but the stuff like The Last of Us, I'll just play the single player campaign for The Last of Us and call it a day.
Well, on my level, I love roguelites. They're like this infinitely playable type of thing. I've been going through Hades. I'm not, like, fully done with it just yet.
Even something like Binding of Isaac.
That's not got much story going on, though. Then you get, like, Dead Cells and stuff. I really like what they did for Assassin's Creed Valhalla's one. I do like the idea of The Last of Us 2 one.
Mm.
Just for, like, more of that gameplay experience. So I would like to see a lot of games add stuff like that into it, or like an arcade sort of thing like they did for the Alan Wake's American Nightmare stuff.
Yeah.
I just think some games have such a nice gameplay experience beyond the story that you just want more of that. And it's always good to just like jump in, jump out without having to sit through a lot of story stuff.
I think the thing that I really enjoyed about Valhalla in particular was I had started a second New Game Plus playthrough of Ragnarok, but I kept getting sort of bogged down by the puzzles and everything, which I don't really want to go through all of the puzzles again. If I could skip them, I would. But this has just given me gameplay.
Mm.
Pure, unadulterated carnage, and really good character work as well, and story work, and hints towards the future. And more music, so...
Oh, more costumes, too.
And more costumes, too, including a very special costume that you get at the end of Valhalla when you complete it. But this made me so happy to get back into what I believe is one of my favorite games, which built on everything that the first...
Well, I think the franchise has done in the past.
The first Norse God of War did, and Ragnarok is very good,
with
Valhalla being a really nice free addition to it.
Because
they added it for free, and it's a lot of really great character stuff, and they've done that instead of paid DLC.
Yeah. So, Lawson, you also have a pit take?
I do indeed. I have gone to the theatre again, and I've seen a smaller play, a more outside-the-box play, at the Ad Astra Theatre, which I've talked about before as being a little black box theatre that does these kind of smaller stuff that's never going to make the main stage at QPAC. It's called The Wolves. It's a coming-of-age drama written by Sarah Delap, and it's basically the before-game warm-ups of an under-17 girls soccer team. It sort of picks up before their matches over period of several weeks, like you keep coming, jumping back into the next game over the next.
That's cool.
The next, every scene's a new game. And over the course of this, you see the friendships, the rivalries, the coming of age stories of all of these characters. It's really a character study. It's a fascinating bit of writing. It's very much about female relationships, about growing up, about girlhood and womanhood and all of the little complicated parts of that. It feels very lived in. It feels very real. As someone who is not a girl or a woman, but I went and saw it with my mother, and she said that we're very, very recognizable, like she knew all of those kinds of people. It has no real narrative. It's not the point of the play. The point of the play is to sort of exist with these characters and their stresses and their successes and their worries and their friendships and their rivalries. There's a lot of bickering, a lot of crosstalk, multiple conversations going on over the stage at once. It's a really intricate bit of writing, and it is brilliantly written. It weaves through some very complex dialogue with a lot of grace. Dolap was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for this play, and she went on to write Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. So we've talked about her work before, but it's all sort of set against this soccer concept, that it's all on the field. Like, they're all warming up on the field before the game, and that's where this all takes place. So, you know, you get this interesting stuff where as these arguments go on, or these, you know, power dynamics within the group goes on, they're like passing the ball back and forth, and it sort of becomes this really interesting piece of symbolism. Everyone has their own threads, their own backstories, their own personalities, and it is really like Dolap has created all these characters, these very distinct characters, put them all in a pressure cooker and just like shaken it, seeing what happens. What happens when they all bounce off of each other? And they are very well-drawn personalities. Some of them are sympathetic, some of them aren't. They're all flawed. I will say that if there's one thing that lets it down, it's the ending. I feel it really is trying to come up with a finale, come up with something that feels like a full stop at the end of the sentence, and it's a little heavy-handed as a result. What has made this play sing has been the casual, undirected interaction between all of these characters, and so the attempt to come up with a inciting event that actually works as an endpoint is working kind of against what the play does best in some ways.
That is the difficulty with not only a play, but like a book or any type of story like that, that's trying to be so naturalistic in its presentation, because the real world doesn't end. It doesn't have wrap-ups.
Yeah.
So that's the inherent struggle with something like that, and I can see that being an issue.
But there are some excellent performances. This is the second show I've seen at the Ad Astra, and they are a small black box theatre. It's a 40-seat theatre. But they operated at a very high standard. Like, this is a very, very well thought through production with some very talented people behind it. And that has been my experience at Ad Astra both times having gone there. I already have tickets for two more of their shows this year. So, I would encourage you to check it out, because they do smaller, off the beaten path kind of plays. They are cheaper than most of the stuff at QPAC as well. They're quite good. That's me done for the week, I think, yes. So why don't we now move on to talking about our deep dive?
Now we will play for you the trailer to Dread.
Feel as if time is passing at 1% its normal speed.
If we play this right, we could take the whole city.
Justice. Syracuse chooses the manufacturing base for all the slow-mo in Mega City 1.
You know how often we get a judge up in peace trees?
Well, you got one now.
She has control of everything. Levels 1 to 200.
This is Mama. Somewhere in this block are two judges.
That's not good.
I want him dead.
We're gonna have to go through him. Rookie, you ready?
Yeah.
You look ready.
Fire!
Judgment time.
Let's finish this.
Mama is not the law.
Was the trailer for Dredd. It is a science fiction action film based on the comic strip Judge Dredd, a breakout inclusion in the long-running British comics magazine 2000 AD. The film takes place in the dystopian future of 2080, after a nuclear war has left huge swathes of the world uninhabitable. All that's left of the United States is a huge walled city running along the eastern seaboard from Boston to Washington, D.C. Numerous high-rises and skyscrapers have sprung up out of necessity to house all 800 million residents of this huge megacity, which has been creatively dubbed Mega City 1. With so many people all crammed together in one place, crime has become a huge problem. 17,000 serious crimes are reported each day, and there's just no way to police it all. The government of Mega City 1 has therefore turned to a delightfully fascist solution, forming an elite organization of what they call judges. Now, this is where my computer crashed and I ran out of time to write the rest of this. So I'm just going to have to summarize it very quickly off the top of the dome here. But the judges are essentially these combat-trained stormtroopers who are imbued with the power to be judge, jury, and executioner. They arrive at the scene of a crime or they catch a criminal and they find them guilty or innocent, just based on their own understanding of the situation, and either kill them or take them off to be sealed inside one of Mega City 1's ISO cubes as punishment. The most feared of these judges is a guy named Dredd. He's played by Carl Urban. We never find out his first name, so I have decided that he is called Darren. Darren Dredd.
In the comics, his first name is Joseph.
Well, there's a lot actually apparently in this that deviates from the comics. Mega City 1's size, for instance, and location deviates.
Just give him this one.
I am sticking with Darren. But Darren has been assigned a new rookie to train, Cassandra Anderson. She's played by Olivia Thirlby. She is a mutant because she has grown up very close to the border of Mega City 1, where the radiation is actually still pretty strong. So most mutants, they grow an extra arm or a leg, or they lack an arm or a leg. But Olivia Thirlby has been lucky enough to end up, A, looking like Olivia Thirlby, and B, have the ability to read people's minds. She's become psychic. And so the judges are very interested in getting her on their team, even though her scores in training haven't been as good as they necessarily could be. So Dredd is sort of assigned to show her the ropes and really decide whether she's going to, in the end, be a fit for the judges. And they go to investigate a triple homicide at a massive 200-story apartment building. Once they get there, though, they discover that it is a hive of criminal activity. It is the location where the drug Slow-Mo is manufactured out of. Slow-Mo makes people perceive time at 1% of its original speed. And they discover that this is all being produced. All of the Slow-Mo in Mega City 1 is being produced on something like the top 20 floors of this building, run by the very unusual character of Mama, played by Lena Headey. They decide that they're going to arrest one of her dealers. And Mama basically is like, nope, because he's going to spill the beans. And so she locks down the entire building, seals them all inside. And Dredd and, or should I say, Darren and Cassandra have to work their way up to the top floor to take care of business, essentially. So, yes, that is the plot of Dredd. Hopefully my computer will play ball next week. I will certainly have a little more time than I've had the last couple of weeks. But why don't we each go around and say what our 30-second thoughts of Dredd are. Why don't you start us off, Sean? Are you ready?
Yep.
3, 2, 1, go.
This is doing something very similar to what Total Recall 2012 has done, where it has taken this concept and instead of being a sort of campy 80s movie, though, even though the Sylvester Stallone Dredd was in the 90s, it has decided to take it completely seriously and be grim. But I think this time, for Dredd, it succeeds. Because it's kind of what this needs. Some of the CGI blood is a little bit bad, but I love all of the stuff with slow-mo, and I love how much time we spend with the characters.
All right, you ready, Harley?
Yep.
3, 2, 1, go.
So, Judge Dredd was created by John Wagner, Carlos Esquerra, and Pat Mills, like you said, in 2000 AD. This was meant to be, it was like built around being a satire of the police force, of authoritarian politics, of basically society post the 1970s. So that's why everything's like hyper-violent, still very punk, still very sort of like 80s in its design. I think the movie is fine.
Alright. I really love this movie. I think it's fantastic. The movie that I find it most closely comparable to isn't Total Recall, it's The Raid. In fact, I would bet money that The Raid is what caused this movie to be greenlit, because it is The Raid. That is what the premise of this movie is. They're fighting up the floors of an apartment building to get to the top where the leader of the bad guys is. It's really well done. There's a lot of really good action. It is a little corny in some points, but like it has such a great sort of pulpy 80s grindhouse aesthetic. I think that's probably a decent enough place to start off. I mean, you talked about how it takes itself more seriously, John, and I think I get what you're saying, but
the Stallone version, definitely.
Yeah, but it's definitely embracing that 80s aesthetic, that sort of...
Oh, yeah, but in a far grimmer, more punk way, in a way that is very much more along the lines of something cheap that someone...
Yeah.
Well, it's more in line with the comics.
It's like lo-fi Verhoeven. Kind of. It's like it's a mix of that aesthetic and something else that kept popping into my head was Hobo with a Shotgun. I think
I was thinking that I was going to say it is kind of like Judge Dredd crossed with Hobo with a Shotgun.
It's doing a much more effective version of what Hobo with a Shotgun did. If you want to hear my thoughts about Hobo with a Shotgun, you can go back and listen to one of our earlier episodes. But Hobo with a Shotgun, I appreciated what it was doing, but I think that it was it was campy. It was a little bit ridiculous, and it didn't have as great a handle on its own tone as Dredd does. Dredd knows when it's silly. It knows that it's got kind of a ludicrous premise, that this whole idea of Mega City 1, of the judges, it's a little bit extreme, and it doesn't try and pretend that it's not. Like the, even to the costume the Dredd's wearing.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a silly costume. And
the fact that he never takes the helmet off.
Mm.
And the fact that watching it, the audience really doesn't care.
Yeah.
Because he's not really a person. You call him Darren, Harley calls him Joseph, but who this man is Dredd.
Well, because it's not his
Judge Dredd.
It's not his movie. That's the interesting thing. He's not the narrative impetus. He doesn't have
this
arc.
This
he
is
doesn't
a
have the...
day in his life.
Yeah. This is Cassandra's movie, if it's anyone's. Mm. She has the arc. She has the emotional development. She has the journey from A to B to C that leaves her in a different spot as a character than when the movie started. Dredd, as you said, is a Tuesday. And I think
to the point where at times he's almost bored of it.
Yeah, that's an interesting approach, and it's an effective one, because when you have a character like this, who is like part of the appeal in some ways of the character, is that they are kind of so stoic and unknowable. Like, we're literally denied access to his face, to his eyes, to one of the stuff that connects us to him emotionally.
One of the ideas in the comics is that Dredd's development as a person is glacial. Like, it takes time for him to, like, change anything about himself, even if he ever does. And that's the sort of perfect setup for a comic book, right?
Yeah.
It's inherently episodic, the format of the comic book and how story arcs work, it's inherently episodic. And you need a character that's going to be able to last the whole thing. Not every event in this person's life is going to be, like, big moment where he discovers something about himself. No, Judge Dredd is doing his job.
I really like Carl Urban here. I think he's an actor that I kind of, like, I always find serviceable but rarely ever impresses me. He impresses me here. I will say he needs to tone down on, like, the weird facial expression that, like, the sort of badass facial. Like,
yeah, that's Dredd, though.
He pulls his face. Yeah, I don't know. There's supposed to look grim, but instead he kind of looked, like, specifically, especially that scene at the end where Lex has shot him and he's, like, saying, really, the famous Judge Dredd, the Judge Dredd, just wants, he's begging, that kind of, that scene. And the, like, look of, like the grimace on his face. The, like, Clint Eastwood at his most confused.
Yeah, it's kind of Clint Eastwood yelling at a chair kind of level.
Mm.
I do agree with that, but other than, like, that, he's captured the character.
I get why he feels like he has to do that. Because
he's
that is all we've got.
Yeah, he's overcompensating. He's lip acting.
You know, like, that's the thing. Or, like, on stage, you have to be bigger than you would be in a movie. When you're wearing a mask, you have to, like, do a lot in the physicality of the body.
Yeah.
But what he has got is a character who is inherently physical, but not very... He's very solid in the way he moves. So he has to be solid in the way he moves. So all he's left with is his bottom jaw, and it's silly.
Yeah.
And I don't like characters with masks and helmets who never take it off. I should say characters we're supposed to relate to or identify with or to root for as the protagonist of our story. Michael Myers can wear a mask all he wants. That's what makes him work as a character.
Yeah.
But, like, it's one of the reasons why I don't have the hero worship for Master Chief that everyone does. Like, everyone's freaking out that Master Chief takes off his helmet in that Halo TV series. I'm like, good, maybe I can start connecting with him as a character. But the thing of it is that Dredd, you don't have to connect with him as a character. You're not supposed to connect with him as a character. Not really. He is literally a stormtrooper. He's a figure of authoritarian fascist control. He's satire of Reagan's America. And that's kind of, it, in that sense, I think that it gets away with it in a way that completely overcomes what I would normally push back against.
Like, at the end of the day, he's not much of a person.
No.
He's Dredd. Mm. He's just Judge Dredd. What do you think he does when he clocks off from the shift? He's not going to the bar with the rest of the boys when they get off shift. He's not going home petting his cat and putting his feet up. I think he just sits in a room and stews. Like,
I think
he just sits in a room and gets angrier and angrier.
I think he's the kind of guy who does everything that is practical. I feel like he has...
His home must be purely functional.
Yeah, pure function is what he is. I don't think he eats things for the flavor. He eats things for caloric intake. He eats things for the energy it can give him. He drinks water when he's thirsty. He sleeps when he's tired.
Other than that,
he just works. And that is such an interesting character because he's uncompromising. Because, as you said, his character moves at a glacial pace.
It's interesting. Sorry, continue.
Sorry, and they're pairing him with a character who has to change. Because Cassandra is at this point in time where she
It's a crossroads.
It's a crossroads. Is she going to be a judge? Is she going to not be a judge? She can see the future, but her future is very unclear. And Olivia Thirlby is really good here.
Well, it's not just that. Her power set.
Yeah.
Like, one of the most enduring things about her. Why she was even put into the situation to begin with. Her power set being a mind reader, a telepath, is inherently emotional. Like, it has to be. So, she's dealing with... The purpose of the judge is to be almost completely heartless.
Mm.
To be a pure function of the state.
Yeah.
And she's failed at almost all of, like, the aptitude, on the aptitude level of things.
Well, she's, like, 3 points below a pass, I think they say.
Mm. And she... But she's an asset.
Yeah.
Because of the way that she can interrogate without even laying a finger on somebody. And that is...
That in itself shows the pure function of the judge system.
That's very interesting because she's coming at things... She still has empathy.
Yeah.
She grew up in a complex just like Peachtree's.
Well, I think that all of the world building, the concept of Judge Dredd, the concept of Mega City 1 and the judges and these giant high rises, that's really cool. It's kind of ridiculous, but it's really cool. And it's very interesting as a satirical concept of the militarization of police. I mean, it makes me really interested to go and see the Stallone one now, because I think that the Stallone one, from what I know of it, plays this concept with much less of a questioning eye, which, knowing Stallone's politics, makes a lot of sense. Like, that's the thing with these 80s movies, that your Verhoevens with RoboCop and Starship Troopers aside, a lot of it was this sort of ultra-violence as a good thing, as a necessary thing, as something that you're supposed to cheer for.
Demolition Man.
Yeah. And so, like, there is, in the underlying of that, this very authoritarian, very ultra-right-wing concept of crime is out of control, the slums are full of criminals, and we just need someone to come in and really just, like, take care of business and not be bound by all the red tape, not be bound by laws or Miranda rights or any of this, you know, touchy-feely liberal stuff, but to come in with a gun and clean up the city. And it's this very... Yeah, and it's a very, I think, it's a point of view that's thrived during the Thatcher-Reagan years all over the world. And I think that the fact that, you know, the 70s and the 80s, which was a period of, like, sort of arch-conservatism, a rise of Reaganism and Thatcherism that would evolve eventually into the type of conservatism we see today, I think that that is not at all a coincidence that the golden age, quote-unquote, of action movies, your Arnold Schwarzeneggers, your Sylvester Stallones, your Dolph Lundgrens, your Jean-Claude Van Damme's, your Steven Seagal's, they come about during this period, and that it's usually built on that idea of the one guy who's got the individual who must come in because the state has failed in its responsibility to police undesirables.
Well, and that's the interesting thing about the original team being based in Britain.
Mm.
The fact that 2000 AD is a British comic book. And what's interesting to me about that is not only are they commenting on the tenement system over there, the fact that there's a lot of these high-rise buildings with low-income housing that are simply targets of the police at times. Mm. The fact that they're responding to the Thatcher stuff, they're responding to the war on terror, and I do find there's something interesting that they're doing all of that, but also as outside observers looking at the States.
Yeah.
Looking at America and the militarization of the police over there. The idea that America, in and of itself, has taken on this responsibility of policing the world. The idea that they're the shining example on the hill. And this is
they
the sort
justice.
Of.
They are justice. They are the law.
Exactly. And
law?
And there's the idea that, as outside observers, like we are today, that we can look at the United States and go, that's fucking bullshit. And, I don't know, there's like something to that that's very, very interesting.
And it seems to me like something that this movie struggles a little bit with,
yeah.
because it's given itself a really excellent premise. It's given itself an absolutely like dynamite idea of Judge Dredd and his rookie trainee trapped inside this building. They're going to work their way through it. Great action, great set pieces, but it leaves very little time to really dig into the underlying ideas of that. They do try. They do talk about like, what does justice mean? Justice isn't black and white, with the whole Olivia Thirlby letting Domhnall Gleeson go. They have a little bit of like, I mean, just the way that people respond to Dredd, almost with fear rather than anything else. Because
they know that judges have gone into that building without warrants and just yeah. brutalized people.
Yeah. And
because that's the thing. The judges are judge, jury, and executioner. They not only like solve the crimes, they not only take part in the active prevention and ending of crime, they decide the sentence. Like, when a judge sentences you, that is it. Like, obviously it has to be to the correct standard, but let's be frank, not a lot of those judges are as strict as Dredd is.
Mm.
And it's akin to those stories that you hear of police brutality, a police officer reacting and getting it wrong. There was that story recently, or that video, of a cop in America, an acorn fell on his car.
He thought it was a gunshot,
so he starts unloading rounds into
his own squad vehicle,
a neighborhood. And it's a situation of people who have become so ramped up, amped up, to be a hero, to be a warrior, that it never lets them come down from that energy. And that's kind of what's happened here with the judges.
What I like is that about this movie is that it does show us corrupt judges.
Yes, I was about to say.
Those judges that come in working for Mama to get paid extra because they apparently don't get paid enough.
Mm.
And the idea that they know who Dredd is. They don't know he's there the moment they get there. But as soon as they hear about him, they're like, shit. This is the one guy who's never going to be on the take.
Mm.
We got to take him out.
Yeah.
And it's a situation of...
It's the whole judge versus judge stuff. That's very cool. Because he's on much more equal footing with them.
They're very well-skilled combatants. They've got the same tech as he. I love the way that people react to the judges, and the fact that we see all of these examples from Cassandra where she's trying to figure out what justice is. She is told to execute that guy after the scene when she and Dredd
outside the medical center
kill those guys outside the medical center. She is forced to execute one of the gunmen. And they later go into a woman's apartment and she uses her abilities to figure out that that man that she executed was this woman's husband.
Well, no, she just sees a photo of him. She doesn't need to use her abilities for that. Yeah.
Then she, like, fully confirms it.
And that in itself is interesting of... And we also see two young boys, two teenagers, handed guns and sent to handle Judge Dredd.
Yeah,
and
another of the movies I was thinking about watching this was Attack the Block.
Yeah.
But I you're right that they do make these like little passes at this stuff. But because of the movie that they've made, the premise that they've made, this is like a high octane action film.
Yeah.
It's got to start and not stop.
It's like little things peppered through. It's nothing tremendously substantial.
It's not the meat of the meal, but it's the seasoning.
It does
that
have,
really makes it interesting.
It does, I think that a non-critical viewer could very easily watch this movie and be like, yeah, judges, woohoo, you know, taking care of business.
And a lot of people who read the comics do think that. That's how we got
fans
that's
of
how,
the Punisher.
That's how we got the Stallone Judge Dredd after all.
Mm.
And like there's the idea of like characters like the Punisher, like John said. The idea that you get some cops who put the Punisher logo as patches on their uniforms, as like soldiers who do the same thing. And there's the idea that the Punisher is not the Punisher, Judge Dredd, in the Dark Tower with a gunslinger. They're not good examples of how to treat people. They're bad examples of how to treat people. They might be, like, in the case of Dredd, he's probably the best of the judges at this, especially when you consider characters like Judge Death, who is, like, a legitimate monster.
Well, I do think it's a situation
of there is a lack of media literacy amongst a lot of people.
They do make choices with Dredd that I think is designed to do that. They kind of, to soften him a bit, to allow us to root for him despite what he represents. Like at the beginning where he just gives the homeless person a warning, but he's going to arrest him on the way back when he's still there.
He did say, "I've got stuff to do.
Move
Don't
on.
Be."
Yeah.
Well, he turns to Cassandra and says, "Pass judgment," and she says something like, "The murder investigation takes precedent," and he says, "Correct. Yep. Don't be here when we come back."
The most obvious part of this is when he's confronted by the two kids. He does threaten them and saying, you know, bullet or juvie cell doesn't really matter to me. But when the rubber hits the road and
stuns him.
Kay jumps out and, you know, grabs at Olivia Thirlby, he takes the time to switch to stun to get rid of them. Like, he doesn't just shoot them like he said he would. He does have a code, I suppose.
Yeah, Dredd is described as having a sense of honor. Like, when he says, "I am the law," he means that. The letter is the way he looks at things. Not twisting it to become more violent. Again, not twisting it to become more lenient either. He is strict. He's the Inspector Javert sort of thing.
As plain as the letters on the page.
Yeah, and the thing about one of the little humanizing elements is how he's constantly checking in with Anderson. Like the whole, like, always, like, looking at her going, "What do you think?"
Yeah.
Because, like, even through this, like, very high octane experience that is probably very, very traumatic to a lot of the people of the building.
For a bunch of the people in this movie, including probably Anderson, this is the worst day of their lives. However, for Dredd, he is still on the clock.
He's like, the little check-ins are very funny to me because it's when he's just like calm and he's like, "So, how do you think today is doing? How are you, Anderson?
What do you think we should do?"
Like, he's still got like teacher mode on.
He's still,
which is very funny.
He's still in, "I'm teaching someone how to do this."
Like, I've done that at work.
Yeah.
I've been in supervisor mode before.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how it is.
But yeah, because that's, as we said before, it's Cassandra's movie. She gets the arc. And I think that Thirlby is very, very impressive here. Even more than Urban is, I think she's very, very impressive. And I think that she's taking the emotion and the character development that the script gives her, and does give her some. This is a script, by the way, written by Alex Garland, of all people. Ex Machina, Annihilation, Men, soon to be Civil War. And
it's probably
which we're all excited about
and semi-dreading.
Yeah. It's a very kind of interesting choice for him.
I think that the script, much like Dredd himself, is functional. It's very Spartan.
Well, if anything, I think it definitely understands its source material.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, it's very accurate, and that's what the creative team behind the original character have said. Like, the spirit is correct. The characters are right. The way that Anderson is portrayed is exactly how she should be portrayed. But in that, the script is very deliberate, it is Spartan, it is focused on what it is, and it's not, there's very little tangential thinking going on here. It's probably the least complex Garland script I've come across.
Oh, easily.
And I think that's a very interesting writing exercise, you know what I mean? Because when you have to boil things down to their basics, you can come up with some really, really good but very functional writing.
Let's talk a little bit about the action. because I think it is very well done. I think there are times where the effects are clearly beyond the budget. You already mentioned, Sean, the CGI blood.
And it's really just through the slow-mo stuff that the CGI blood becomes a real issue. Outside of that, it's like quick stuff. Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of intentional because that whole slow-mo, those segments become very hyper-real and oversaturated. And I think they look kind of ugly, which is odd because when they're talking about it on the behind-the-scenes stuff on the disc, they're talking about how, oh, slow-mo makes everything look beautiful. And I'm like, well, you've kind of made it like this sort of extremely...
You've made slow-mo disgusting.
Yeah.
But I think that works. It adds to the griminess and the grunginess. I think they've sort of in shooting for the moon, they've ended up on a different planet and found life there. And I love the slow-mo here. I love slow-mo as a concept. It allows for some really brutal things. As you were saying, the fake blood, the CGI blood, doesn't look great, but we get a few excellent sequences. Like the idea of hitting someone with slow-mo and then throwing them off of the top floor of this building.
What's not even the top floor?
But like it's insane because this person would be terrified for the equivalent of half an hour as they fall, and that is brilliant, that is fascinating, that is terrifying.
Well, you kind
it's a brutal thing to do to someone.
Yeah. You kind of get over it after a couple of minutes, wouldn't you? Like, you kind of, like, plateau.
It's like,
that's what I was thinking, yeah.
You pull way down, it's like, oh, well, nothing left to worry about at this point.
I don't know.
I have just been skinned after all. I should worry a little bit about that.
I don't know. I've never fallen off a building, so I have no way of telling you, but...
But what works for me about how ugly the slow-mo is, and it did kind of bother me by the end, is the fact that it does look ugly. It's got that thin film of filth about it, and they're using an illicit drug.
And
how else is it going to look?
And it's shot very well as well. I really enjoy the fact that it is such clean slow-mo. There's a channel on YouTube called The Slow-Mo Guys. Gavin Free is one of them. People would know him from Rooster Teeth and Achievement Hunter. But he's an expert at slow-mo, and he was... the slow-mo cinematographer for this
film. One of the only people certified and knowledgeable enough to use that type of camera. Like, he's one of the foremost experts in the world at using that technology.
And the slow-mo is so well done and used very well. I do have to say, I love some of the other effects. I think there's I don't know if it's CGI or if they've got an actual practical effect, but when Dredd has that guy and the person's taken the hostage at the beginning of the movie, how he shoots the hot shot into the guy's mouth and it burns the guy's skull. I don't know if that was a practical effect, but that was gnarly as hell.
I think that was CG.
Yeah, probably.
But
think about the budget this thing was working with.
I know, but it looks gnarly. It's that sense of brutality that this movie has.
Well, there's the bit where he's fighting that huge judge, where he's like, shit, explosive round. All right.
Yeah, he's out of every piece of ammo. It's very effective. Like, why doesn't he just use that all the time? it's very well directed.
Not every situation needs to set a place on fire.
It's very well directed by Pete Travis. He does a good job. It's interesting. He never really got this bigger movie again after this. I mean, this movie did underperform pretty dramatically. I mean, it's a cult hit, but it only grossed $41 million on a $50 million budget. So it was a failure. He had done a movie a few years beforehand that I have seen and talked about on the podcast called Vantage Point. But he mostly comes from British television, and that's mostly where he's gone back to. He's actually, somewhat bizarrely, if you only know him from this movie, just directed a mini-series about Marie Antoinette as his most recent credit. Sofia Coppola and the guy who directed Judge Dredd, like, those are your your two Marie Antoinette go-tos, I suppose. But it is very well done, and he does have talent at using style to overcome shortcomings in effects and shortcomings in budget. It doesn't always work, but I think he picks his moments quite well.
Mm. I do love the practical feel of the costumes.
Yeah.
Like, there's something nice and tangible about it. Obviously, a lot of people are just wearing, like, street clothes and stuff, but the judges themselves, the way that they're designed here, the helmets are a bit big and silly, but all of the other gear, the sort of pauldrons they have on their shoulders, and the guns themselves, the gun itself, like the judge's lawmaker weapons, they're very interesting, and I do like how they're booby-trapped. And they're, like, they're not just booby-trapped for judges, like, they're booby-trapped for the specific person. Mm. So if one of those other judges were to pick up Dredd's weapon, or Dredd were to pick up their weapon, kaboom! Like, nobody is supposed to touch those weapons but themselves.
Kay handles it without it going off. It's pulling the trigger.
Yeah. I just think there's a lot of really, like, neat sort of action stuff. I do like the bit where, after Mama has, like, destroyed that whole portion of the building with the mounted machine guns, Dredd just grabs her second in command, drags him out to the balcony, and throws him off. Just, like, doesn't even take a breath, doesn't even skip a beat, just walks over, throws him, just walks back into the dust and mist.
What do you make of the character of Mama? Because I think that that's one of the most confused bits of politics that the movie has, I think, that she is this sex worker who was violently attacked by her pimp and has responded to this by becoming the most sort of brutal gang leader imaginable, like skinning people and throwing them off of buildings with drugs to make them feel every moment of it at 1% the normal rate. I mean, that she's gone so far into this, like, incredibly violent, incredibly cruel angle is interesting to me that the movie pitches her that way, given the origin that it gives her. And it makes me kind of, like, that's the one part of it where I do think it gets kind of confused about its justice messaging.
Well, at the end of the day, I do think the character of Mama is functional.
Mm.
She's a bad guy.
Yeah.
She's the villain here. And there's not, like, they...
Why have you got to make her a victim turned bad guy, though? Why can't she just be a gang leader?
Yeah.
Why can't she be, I don't know, the daughter of a gang leader or something? I don't know. Some other backstory that...
Well, I do think that...
doesn't connect her viciousness to a violent attack on herself.
Well, I think it's part of the whole trying to make the world more brutal thing.
Yeah.
Like, it just makes the world a little dingy, a little dirtier, and that does come at the expense of, you know, turning people who are victims into victimizers. And, you know, that is... it's present in a lot of movies like this. You know what I mean?
Mm. Well, you do get that stuff within the film too, like the medic who won't help them once everyone's sealed in. Like, there's a part of it that's just these people are forced to exist in the world that they exist in. And they can't necessarily pick the bright and shiny option. It's not available to them a lot of the times.
Yeah. Like, there's not much of choice going on.
Yeah.
Well, that goes into how, like, you could probably tell a bunch of the people in Mama's cartel, they're just residents who want to survive.
Yeah.
Like, Anderson was talking about, like, this building is full of families just trying to make it through the day. And Mega City 1, Peachtree's itself, it's not built for people to survive in. Mm. It's not built for society to thrive. This is the remnants of an old world that is very much in the process of moving on.
Mm.
And the sort of post-apocalyptic element of it, the fact that this is one of the lost bastions of humanity, is very, very cynical, very, very satirical, because if you look at that world that's been created, we're not doing a very good job with it.
Did you know that there are Judge Dredd novels?
I was aware, yes.
Might actually be interested in checking out those, because they've got, like, short story ones, they've got, like, stuff about Dredd, but then there's stuff about Cassandra by herself. There's stuff about the judges, which is the history of the judges as an institution before Dredd comes along. There's also, apparently, he has crossed over with Batman quite a number of times.
Yeah, it's kind of in the same line as when Spawn has his crossovers, when the Shadow has his crossovers. It's like non-canonical stuff. I checked out that Spawn and Batman thing, and that was fine. But, like, Dredd, to me, is one of those characters a lot like Spawn. Like, conceptually, just looking at the character, I'm like, oh, yeah, I get it. A lot of patches, though. A lot of, pouches. Lots of belts and stuff. But, like, I can appreciate characters like Dredd, Spawn, and others of the oeuvre, because, like, I was born in the 90s, grew up for a portion of my life in the 90s. I have somewhat of an appreciation for characters like that. I think, but for me, I'm on a level where I feel like I do have a disconnect from characters like that. The hyper-violent era of comic books.
I think we should talk about Cassandra as a character.
Yeah, she is sort of the redeeming aspect that they throw in here to give it an emotional through line. Because, like I said, I think that you do need a character that is not helmeted and monotone.
Yeah. In fact, she forgets the helmet because it doesn't help.
She intentionally leaves it behind. Yeah. She doesn't forget it.
Because it doesn't help with her. It gets in the way of her ESP, but like a bullet's going to do the same thing as Judge Dredd says.
And it's interesting because she's a way of being able to read not only the other people in the building, but Dredd himself. There's that introduction to her abilities where Lex says, okay, who am I how many people are watching you? Two.
That's not Lex.
That's the chief.
Lex is the guy and that is the leader of the
village. Sorry. The chief says, okay, how many people are watching you? Two. What can you tell me about the other person in this room with me?
He's a judge.
But there's something beneath that something, and then they stop.
And then, chief is just like, I wouldn't go there.
And I like that that Anderson is able to, as a character function, to give those little bits of overtures towards something more complex behind the facade of Dredd. But I think she herself is an interesting character. She's got a different belief in what justice is. As he said, she lets Domhnall Gleeson go because she sees that he's as much of a victim as a lot of these other people in the building are. The cat and mouse game that she has with the drug dealer who they've not kidnapped, arrested, that's what it's called. And the sort of to and fro that they have is also interesting because we spend a lot of time with him as well, sort of trying to understand the gang.
Well, he completely underestimates her. Like, there's that scene where he pitches stuff in an attempt to shock her, and, you know, you get the impression that maybe she is a little rattled that time, but by the time it comes to interrogate him and get inside his head, like, he's shown his hand. She knows what he's like, what he's going to do, and she turns her back on him.
She has better control of her mind than he does.
And it's a thing of, that's really all you've got? Like, that's really the only thing you can hit me with. Well, I'm going to make you piss yourself.
Well, I think that it's interesting that what it chooses to show her receiving as information and what it doesn't choose. We see a stylized version of what he's thinking when he imagines the sexual encounter with her. But when he says, well, if I really wanted to shock you, I'd have thought of something like this. We don't see what he thinks of next.
Yeah.
That actually, she then turns around and smacks him really hard.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what that was, but it must have been something pretty extreme. The other, like, a bit that I like, that they come up with this visual language, this filmic language, visual audio, that tells us when she's receiving a sort of a psychic intuition. So when she runs across that one corrupt judge in the hallway and she's like, I'm your backup, put your gun down, it just does that little blur with the sound and she just shoots her. And you don't need to, you know that she knows, she's had that psychic messaging that this is what's going on, and It's a very smart, very clever shorthand way of doing that.
It's cool to see her, like, operating at her peak by the end.
Mm.
And you see the moment that you see the moment Dredd has her respect.
Mm.
And the moment she has Dredd's respect. Like, that part where he's been shot and he just says to Lex, "Wait." And he says, "Seriously, that's all you've got? The great Judge Dredd just wants me to wait. Wait for what?" This.
Huh. Mm.
Bang. Like, come on, man. Can't get caught monologuing.
Yeah, can't get caught monologuing. But it is interesting that it is another little gimmick that the movie is able to do alongside the slow-mo, having her as a precog doing it more successfully than
not a precog. Need to make that clear. She doesn't see the future. She reads minds.
Yeah.
Sure. And it's very well handled here, I think.
I do love the part where they're in the... where they've arrested him, they're in the elevator, and she says, "He's thinking of going for your gun." He's changed his mind. It's almost a situation where both of them look at her like, yeah, no shit.
What did you think of the music? I thought that the music was very well done in the way that it sort of captured that 80s sci-fi action aesthetic.
I think it was fine.
It's industrial, it's gritty, it's harsh.
Mm.
It's what it needs to be. It's functional.
Yeah.
I
electronic vibe to it works.
I can't
quite well
think of a specific moment or piece of music. It just fits the aesthetic and it fits the tone. It fits the mood. I like the ending that we don't actually get to see the decision Cassandra makes.
Well, she handed in the badge.
She hands in the badge.
Yeah, because she thought she'd failed.
Mm.
And,
like,
and
at the end, you do get that scene of her walking towards Dredd in her uniform. Mm. Like, I think that it's... well, especially considering that she becomes a judge in the comics. I think that's probably... Yeah. If they were successful enough to get a sequel, which they weren't, but I'm sure they wanted.
I do feel like
she would have been back.
I do feel like that's one of the things holding this movie back, though. This is it's episodic. It's a
this
day.
This is chapter one.
This is I wouldn't even say that. It's a day in a life. This is simply a shift.
And it goes back to the way that they wanted to write Dredd in this movie. That Alex Garland has spoken and uses the glacier as symbolism. That it is a slow crawl towards change. It's annoying that we haven't gotten sequels, that the TV show that they said they wanted to do has just been stuck being written in development hell, probably won't ever happen.
Yeah, it was going to be about the judges, not necessarily about Dredd. I mean, Carl Urban had sort of talked about it as being something he was interested in coming back for, and his impression that he had gotten from talking to the people behind it had been that it was going to be about the judges themselves, and Dredd would be like a recurring character.
Mm. Which is possibly the best function for him.
Yeah.
He just shows up from time to time.
It's a situation where you can see them setting up all of these things for the future, and not for lack of trying, not for lack of desire, but just not being able to do any of that stuff. We are seeing the first inklings of the thought of taking a step towards character progression for Dredd.
Well, it's...
But we don't get that payoff.
It's not as distinctly obvious as something like the Divergent series, where they have a series in mind. This is just something where it's like, oh, cool, this is something that has happened, this is a shift, this is a day, and what happens next? What is their next... Hard to even say adventure at this point, because there's something so, like, I keep saying it, functional about Dredd himself, that he could assist Anderson on another case later down the line. And...
Well, yeah, we keep coming back to that, because Dredd can never be the emotional plot driver.
No.
That's not what the character is. I mean, the Dredd is the icon of the series, but what we're really there for is the world, is the lore, is the
how
setup.
People respond to Dredd.
Exactly. Which is why it works more as satire than it does as something played straight, in my opinion. Because played straight, it ends up being pretty hollow. I don't think that you could get much mileage out of doing, you know, a series of stories like that. I think that this movie works because it's new. It does have a newness to it that gives it a boost in terms of its success and, you know, holding the attention. I do think if they had continued on, they would have had to layer in more of that satirical element, more interrogation of the ideology, if they had wanted it to maintain a sort of freshness and a currency, because you couldn't, I don't think, just do Die Hard 2, you know? It's like Die Hard, frankly. That's a decent thing, you know? You have to keep finding something to give it that little bit of a boost, because if you don't, then it just ends up being the same story over and over.
Yeah.
I do think we've reached the end of the conversation here. I do have one entry in the IMDb Parents Guide this week. It is, for listeners who are not familiar, the IMDb Parents Guide is when we talk about the prudish and or pervy sections in the movie of the week. This is just one entry. In violence and gore, someone dies.
Talk about pure function. Mm-hmm. That's an understatement. Talk about
also,
pure function.
Just a side note, that was the only entry hidden under the spoiler tag.
Very helpful.
I mean, technically, yeah, that could be a spoiler. It's vague enough to be a spoiler, sure.
Well, why don't we now move on to recast this movie with Muppets for the Muppet parody version, The Muppet Dread. I have thought about this a lot, and I think I have really settled on the ideal for our two leads. You keep Olivia Thirlby. For Dread, Sam the Eagle.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got that. He's very solid. He's very stoic. And you need a character like that to play Dread.
But can you just imagine, like, Sam the Eagle coming out and throwing that guy off, off the balcony?
And then just see him walking back silhouetted.
Yes, exactly. It's good stuff.
Domhnall Gleeson is Beaker.
Yes. Bunsen is the guy in the medic center.
Yep.
Miss Piggy as the Lena Headey character.
Naturally.
As Mama. For the two teenagers that try and hold Dredd up, that's Gonzo and Rizzo.
Oh, how did we get ourselves in this situation?
Just point your gun!
I was thinking Dr. Teeth for Kay, for the drug dealer that they've got under arrest for most of it.
I don't know, he's too benevolent.
Is he?
Teeth.
Yeah. Well, why are you discounting the acting abilities of Teeth? What?
Teeth has... I think he's got range.
Is there a... What? Sure, who would you put in
that? He's certainly
done
enough drugs in his time.
I mean, you... Who? What character has the?
Yeah, I'm just trying to find one of the more like.
Yeah. What is the
villainous
scumbag,
seeming Muppets?
The
that
scumbag
aren't...
drug dealer Muppet. Like maybe that guy is trying to blow everything up. Crazy Harry.
Again, he's too crazy. He's like too off the wall. And like you can't do an Uncle Deadly. He's too refined.
Yeah. Which is why I'm going with Teeth, because he's got that sort of like
Pepe the King Prawn.
Of grunge. Yes. 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 You're right. I do think
because you needed someone dodgy who's not always off the wall.
He's got a bit of a pervy edge to him as well.
Pervy the King Kong,
absolutely it works.
Do you bring the Electric Mayhem in as the corrupt judges?
Yes. Oh, that's so good.
Part of me likes
that.
That
is
a lot.
So good, and it fits because. You have Janine there as the one that Olivia Thirlby reads
Janice.
The mind of. Yeah,
Janice.
That's really good.
And then you have Kermit as the right-hand man of Mama who San Diego
gets
throws
thrown
over.
Off the build.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got it. We've figured it out.
We've cut and paste, gang. We're done. This is our Muppets Dread.
That's, I think, one of the best fitting ones we've had in a while.
Yeah, this one works, like... Very nicely.
Just the idea of slow-mo Miss Piggy being thrown from the top of a building and just flopping in the way that a Muppet would.
No, like, that's just exact. When she lands, it's just what happens when a puppet lands on the ground.
Yeah, no blood. It's
no
just...
blood or anything. It's just...
Oh, yeah, that fits.
So now,
good picks.
Now, why don't we go around and say who our MVP is for this movie, what our favorite scene or sequence is, And of course, who we would recast with this podcast's patron saint, character actor John Lithgow.
Knock, knock, who's there? Me!
I will start us off, and I will say that my MVP for this movie is Olivia Thirlby. She is the presence that this movie is riding on. I don't think this movie works if you don't have her doing as good a job as she is, because she needs to be the emotional center. She needs to be the emotional heart. She needs to actually sell us that there's something here in this narrative that isn't just hard-edged violence, ultra-violence. You know, you need something there, some humanity. And I think she provides that, whereas Dredd by himself would not. In terms of my favorite scene or sequence, I mean, it's kind of hard to separate this movie into scenes or sequences because it really is a very long action scene. I think what I've got to go with is probably the big fight when Mama really comes down to get her hands dirty with the Gatling gun. That sort of concludes with them throwing themselves out through a hole in the wall and ending up in the 100-story skate rink that is inexplicably doesn't have enough guardrails or anything. Like, whoa, no.
Those kids are playing with fire.
I think that's a great action scene. It has some very strong visuals. It really does sort of show this movie at its energetic, most high-octane self. It is a very striking moment. I mean, if I was being more granular, if I wasn't looking for a whole scene, then I'd pick that bit where Judge Dredd fires the incendiary bullets, because that was really awesome.
It was sick, yeah.
Yeah. Who I would recast with this podcast's patron saint character actor John Lithgow, there's really not a lot for him here. He does not fit as many of the male characters here. He doesn't really fit as the scummy drug dealer types. He doesn't really fit as the hard-edged, you know, sort of judge types. I was left with two options, both of which would have been cameos, but one of which would have made sense as a cameo, where the other one would have been like, well, wait, hang on, why is John Lithgow here? and so I've chosen...
Which has an energy in itself.
Yeah. I've chosen him as the Chief Justice, the one that we just see at the very beginning, at the very end, the sort of M to Judge Dredd's James Bond. She comes in, we would obviously be recasting him as a male, but she comes in at the beginning to sort of introduce him to Cassandra. She comes in at the end to debrief. I think that would be a good use of John Lithgow. It's the right kind of role where getting a high-profile actor makes sense, because the other one I was thinking about was the medic, and I think that it would just sort of set him up as being a third-tier supporting player too much, and it wouldn't quite ring the same way. So I'm going with that.
For me, I'm going to have to say my MVP here is Olivia Thirlby. She is the emotional core to this. She is our anchor character. Not only is she being introduced to a lot of these concepts, but she's a good way to give us a perspective on Dredd himself. All the stuff with her, like, visions and stuff, that's well done. And I think that she is doing a lot, whereas a lot of other characters simply don't have the script for that. So she's kind of the only character you can grab onto and go with, even though Dredd himself is very clear in who he is. I do think that my favorite scene or sequence has to be the whole opening sequence, I think. The stuff with the narration telling us what Mega City 1 is, what the world is like, and introducing us to Dredd, that whole sequence. It just lets us know who and what this guy is. And it gets us set up in this world, and the way that that scene ends with the hostage being taken and him shooting it with the hot shot, that's just, it tells you everything you need to know. Not only about that character, but about the judges in general, and why Anderson sort of differs from them in how she operates. Because Dredd is like the epitome of the judge. And Anderson can be better than that. Better than the letter of the law. More compassionate than the letter of the law. Who had we called for John Lithgow? It's really just the chief, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Pickings are slim on the ground in this instance. You'd have to gender swap the character, but that's all I got. That's all I got.
Yeah, for my MVP, it's Olivia Thirlby, because she does the emotional heavy lifting for this film. She's really good here, and she clearly fits with this kind of movie, with the action and everything. And I think she should definitely be in more stuff. My favorite scene or sequence is, as Harley said, that opening. The fact that we get situated in Mega City 1, that we're introduced to the ideas, we're introduced to slow-mo in a very cool way. And that ending of that scene with the hot shot in the mouth is just the perfect cap of that little Judge Dredd short film. It just fits. And it's so brutal, and the effect is really, really well done. Who I would get John Lithgow as is probably as the Chief. There's really no one else you can pick, because no one else really fits John Lithgow. Although you can imagine him back in his sort of Ricochet days as probably one of the criminals who lives in this apartment. But yeah, as Lithgow as the Chief.
So there you have it. Now we are going to put it to a vote. Whether or not we're a pro-Dread podcast or not, Lawson, will you cast your vote first?
I'm saying yes. I think this is a very successful movie. It is exhilarating to watch. It has really interesting world building. I would love to see this world continued in some way. I think that TV show sounded like a great idea. Unfortunately, it's been so long since we heard anything about it. I think it's pretty safe to say that we're not going to see it, at least not that version of it. But I very much like the sort of 2000 AD aesthetic in general, the that kind of thing. So I am kind of a sucker for this, and I think that this is a really successful version of it as well. I mean, the Raid, science fiction, The Raid is an easy sell for me.
Yeah, so I'll go next. It's a pro from me. I think the action is so well done. We're situated in this world very well. The world itself is so fascinating. The fact that it isn't the meat of it, but it has these little moments of seasoning, of questioning the judges and their efficacy, questioning whether this is justice, whether this is the law, or whether this is just control instead of justice. But more than that, it's just a well-made action film with some great sequences and some really strong acting, particularly from Olivia Thirlby.
For me, I can't quite get there. I did start this episode by saying that the movie was fine. It just didn't stick with me very much. I appreciate what it's doing. I think it's certainly smarter than the previous Judge Dredd movie we've got. And I do see what it's doing, and I appreciate what it's doing. I just, when we finished watching the movie the other night, I just felt kind of nothing. And that's a shame, because I see what it's doing, and I understand what it's doing. I just can't quite get there. I'm not anti, not even close, but it's just not for me, I think. So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, we are not a pro-Dread podcast. Aww. So if you'd like to reach us, you can find us on our Twitter, which is the best place to give us episode-specific feedback and movie recommendations. What do you think about Dread? Do you prefer this Dread? Do you prefer the Stallone Dread? Or are you more of a comics purist? All of that on our Twitter. You can also like, rate, comment, share, and subscribe on your podcast app of choice. Just keep in mind, on certain podcast apps, when you do comment, it's for specific episodes and not others. It is for the show on the whole. I understand Spotify is for specific I understand that Spotify is for specific episodes, while stuff like Apple Podcast is for the show on the whole. Your mileage simply varies depending on what service you use. But please do like, comment, rate, share, and subscribe. Australia is a lonely wasteland. Within it lies a city. Outside the boundary walls, a dangerous world. A cursed earth. Inside the walls, a cursed city. Stretching from Brisbane to the Gold Coast, an unbroken metropolitan landscape. 400 million people living in the ruin of the old world and the megastructures of the new one. Mega buildings, mega highways. Mega city, BNE. Convulsing, choking, breaking under its own weight. The citizens in fear, hiding in the dioramas of the mascots. Only one thing fighting for order in the chaos. The only natural predator that still remains to the machines, the only creature alive that they are scared of. I have, of course, I, of course, am talking about the natural evolution of the emu, the cassowary. They just don't get cassowaries. Just the aggression on display, it just throws them out.
Mm.
Most mascots actually shut down when witnessing one.
Just they're like, terrifying.
They can't perceive the bird.
They've got the beefiness of an emu with the just the fury of a Tasmanian tiger. They are vicious birds, but fantastic birds. So, Lawson, aside from that really terrifying glimpse of our potential future, what have you got cooking for us next week?
Well, next week we will be concluding what has been a sort of serendipitous three-part science fiction action movie trilogy. We will be talking about what is, I think, safe to say, the most critically acclaimed version of that trilogy. It is Rian Johnson's 2012 film Looper, which I understand neither of you have seen, correct?
No, but I'm a fan of the rest of the man's work. We covered, well, we haven't covered Knives Out.
We covered Brick in the last, and The Last Jedi.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to this.
You can find it available for streaming in Australia on Foxtel Now and Stan. You can also find it available for purchase or rental on the Apple, Amazon, YouTube, and Fetch stores.
Excellent. So join us next week for when we discuss Looper. Till then, I've been Holly Lewis.
I've been Lawson Keeney.
And I have been and will continue to be Sean Lewis.
And I am the law.